Call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:09 p.m. on Monday, March 4th, 2011. Present today, Representative Keller, Representative Grunberg, Representative Holmes, and myself, Vice Chair Thompson. Let the record also reflect that Chair Gatto and Representative Lynn are excused from the committee today. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. Just turning them to vibrate will still interfere with the recording system. Thank you. If you want to leave them on, though, we could use some donuts in here. At today's meeting, we will hear House Bill 168, Injunction Security and Industrial Operation, sponsored by Representative Feige, House Bill 6, Removing a Regent, sponsored by Representative Grunberg, and House Bill 1, Policy for Securing Health Care Services, sponsored by Representative Gatto. It's my intention today, if it is the will of the committee, to move these bills from the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present House Bill 168, Injunction Security, Industrial Operation, is the sponsor, Representative Feige. Representative Feige, please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and give the committee a brief refresher on House Bill 168.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Eric Feige, representing House District 12.
We've been joined by Representative Pruitt. Representative Feige to find which page he's on.
While we're waiting, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can I ask the sponsor if he's wearing his shorts underneath this?
I've been channeling Freddie Mercury.
For those that are on the record listening.
Sure, that's what you meant.
That's what you meant.
Once again, on House Bill 68, this is a
168.
Sorry, House Bill 168. This is a bill that essentially backs up Court Rule 65C and pertaining to injunctions and restraining orders. What it does, it requires the court to consider specifically the costs associated with an injunction that is brought as a result of an injunction that is imposed as a result of a lawsuit pertaining to certain resource-related projects. And online, we should have some folks to answer questions from DNR, DEC, and Department of Law, as well as from the court system.
Okay. Is there any questions of the sponsor by the committee? Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I recall, I know it's been a week or two since we talked about this last, but as I recall, we had some discussion last time the bill was up about whether or not a court rule amendment might be necessary. And as drafted, there is no court rule amendment in the bill as drafted. We have a legal opinion that I believe all the members have, which was dated March 21st, 2011, and addressed to Representative Grunberg. And on page 3 of that legal opinion, it says, if House Bill 168 is interpreted to require wages, benefits, and contract payments to be covered by security, then House Bill 168 may be interpreted to change a court rule. So I guess my question is, is it the sponsor's intention? Obviously, the language that's in this bill is fairly similar to Court Rule 65, and that's obviously intentional. And I guess my question is the language that's would be new in this statute is the language that includes, that references wages, benefits, and contract payments. And so is it the sponsor's intent to require that the security cover wages, benefits, and contract payments?
The intent of the bill is to make sure that the court at least includes that in their consideration for the security amount. I don't believe it directs them to impose that particularly, but it does ask that they consider that in the.
Okay, but to be clear, it would not require the court to cover those. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we had that the way it was stated on the record. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
With that clarification, that there's not to be any change in the court rule, but simply an admonition in the judge's discretion that we'd like that to be considered, then I don't think a court rule is required, and I feel much more comfortable with the bill. I'd like it crystal clear on the record. Do you agree with my interpretation that this is simply an admonition to the judge that we request that they consider it, but it's still in the court's discretion? Is that your interpretation?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, correct.
That's great. And I will have a dialogue with you on, or Representative Holmes, one of us, will have a dialogue with you on the House floor to put that on the record again. And I think that that's most important. Then we don't need a court rule indirect, the normal, and we don't need the two-thirds vote. And I feel that this is in line with Civil Rule 65C, and I am comfortable with the bill.
Further questions, Representative Pierre?
No. One thing.
Representative Grunberg.
We have a proposed amendment, Bailey B.2, and I'm going to move it. If somebody would object, then we can discuss it.
Object.
Thank you.
We have a move to Amendment 1, an objection. Representative Grunberg,
thank you, Mr. Chair. If the members would contrast the language of the bill with Civil Rule 65C, which you should all have copies of. The bill itself, the key language, is on page 1, line 10, in an amount determined by the court. The language in Rule 65C, in such sum as the court deems proper, and this is, as I interpret it, and I'm going to ask, with the chair's permission, the sponsor of the bill, Representative Feige, this is to once again make it very clear that the bill tracks the rule and is intended to do exactly the same thing as the rule. May I inquire, Mr. Chair?
Go right ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Do you agree that that's your interpretation as well?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I agree.
Thank you. I would ask that objection be removed and that we adopt Amendment 1.
I am not ready to remove the objection. I'd like to speak to it a little bit.
Representative Keller, go ahead.
As I understand it, the determination is a final judgment, and I think by leaving it in there, as opposed to considering and pondering, the intent, as expressed by the sponsor here, is not to force them to do it. Will drive it further toward making a determination of how much money should be involved as opposed to just leaving it real loose. It's a little tighter to use the word determination. I'm not an attorney, and I would like you to explain that a little better to me, but I know that a determination is more, is tighter, than what you're proposing.
Representative Holmes first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, respectfully would disagree with this. The word determination, as on line 10 of page 1 of the bill, does not refer to any sort of final judgment. I think the word determined there is used in sort of the colloquial sense that we would of everyday speech. It's in an amount decided upon, determined, reached, considered. It doesn't in any way refer to any sort of final judgment, and I think by changing the language, I don't see the substitute language as really changing the meaning of that sentence at all, but I see it as just tracking the court rule and making it just that much clearer that we're not changing the court rule at all. I don't see that it's that this is really a substantive change in the amendment. I see it as simply making it very clear that we are not intending to do anything different from what the court rule does. And therefore, I would suggest that we do it just to make it entirely clear. Otherwise, we might come up with some questions of constitutionality of us trying to amend a court rule when we're really not trying to amend a court rule. So if we track the language of the court rule exactly, it just makes it that much clearer that we're not trying to do that. But that would need a two-thirds vote. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. the next step would be to say the bill isn't even necessary because it's covered in the court rules. I mean, you follow your line of reasoning. And before I'm comfortable with taking out the word determined, I would like to hear, if we could, from the Department of Law. I think we have them online. Just exactly what the effect of changing that wording is, if there is any. If the Department of Law determines there is no effect,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
I don't know if we have Dennis Bailey, who drafted this, on the line.
I don't believe we do, no.
Okay.
We're on the amendment, so you wanted to hear from the Department of Law?
At the point, yeah.
We have quite a few people that are going to be online and also in the room to answer some of those questions that we have. Any further questions directly of the responser on the amendment?
I have another question on the bill, but not on the amendment.
Okay, we can come back to that. We're on the amendment. We have Cam Leonard from the Attorney General's office. We also have Department of Law Tina
Kobayashi.
To answer some of these questions on the proposed amendment. Tina, could you please come forward? Scoot over a little bit. Thank you. Yes, if you'd place your name on the record and give us your affiliation, then we'll have Representative Keller ask you a question that he has.
I'm Tina Kobayashi with the Attorney General's office.
Representative Keller.
Thank you,
question.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tina. You've been here and you followed the the amendment, I assume. You want me to be okay? And my question basically is: does this change the law? I mean, I think it was proposed saying that. This is consistent with the intent of the court rule, and I just want to know what the effect of, if there is an effect beyond just being consistent with a court rule in making the change. It seems to me like the word determined is more specific than what the court seems proper, and that's that.
Representative Keller, through the chair. I would have to agree with Representative Holmes that what this does, because it more closely tracks the actual language of the court rule, it makes it much clearer that statute does not change the court rule, that the discretion is left entirely to the court.
Thank you.
Ms. Kobayashi, I get a little confused in these legal things that you attorneys all seem to be aware of, but. How would the court? How do you see the court handling the procedure to determine what the court considers proper?
I believe that the court will follow the current procedure.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The normal practice for a court is to use the common everyday dictionary definition of terms. And as a matter of fact, that's what the statute says in Title I. And there are several definitions of the word determine. One is to fix conclusively or authoritatively, but another is to find out or come to a decision about, quote, to find out or come to a decision about sick by investigation, reasoning, or calculation to find the answer to the problem. And this is from Webster's Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary. And I believe it's that latter definition that the word determine was in the bill originally, if I may, through the chair. Representative Feige, am I correct that that was the way you were using it in the bill?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that is correct.
And if that was correct, then this new language just restates the intent of an ambiguous word, determine, by tracking the bill so there's no question as to what the bill does.
Another follow-up.
Representative Keller.
Yet also, you're trying to put in the word consider proper, and to me, what that will do is what the law does then is says that that there has to be a discussion or a deliberation, you know, as opposed to there has to be a termination. It does seem quite a bit stronger to me. I mean, consider, if you say consider to be proper, is this proper or not? We can have a long debate on that. And then, you know, it, whether it's fruitful in the final decision as far as what the bill does makes me wonder. You know.
Yeah.
Representative Holmes next, and then you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I'm worried about is if we actually, like I said, I consider this to not be a substantive amendment. I consider it just to be a different way of saying the same thing. And I'm seeing the sponsor of the bill nodding his head. And what I'm concerned about is that if we actually use the language determined by the court because we think it means something different, which is what I hear my colleague over here to my left. what I hear my colleague two seats to my left saying is that these two phrases actually mean something different. And that really worries me, because if it does mean something different, then that means we're actually changing a court rule by using the word determine rather than consider. And I think what we've heard from the sponsor and what we've heard from most, at least Representative Grunberg and myself, is that we don't intend to change the court rule. So if the words determine and consider actually are different, then we're into dangerous ground, because then we're effectively amending a court rule. And we would need to rewrite the bill to reflect that and get a two-thirds majority. And I have not heard that intent from the sponsor. And so I think the closer we track the language of the court rule, the clearer it is that we are constitutional in this bill and that it's not going to get struck down for having amended a court rule without actually saying so. So I would urge the committee to consider adopting this amendment.
I think I'll
we
say
do
that.
Have other people. Pardon?
I think I'll save us some time. So I'll just say, watching the responses from the sponsor and listening to the debate, I certainly don't want to change the bill from what the sponsor wants. And I think what he has indicated, and I'm not even asking him to confirm it because he's already indicated this, this isn't a substance change. It's just a different way of saying it that's consistent. And so I withdraw my amendment.
You withdraw the objection? All right. Seeing no further objection, then we have adopted 27-LS0395/B.2 amendment. Okay. Any further questions of the sponsor, Representative Grunberg?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Something we haven't talked about before.
And we do have, by the way, a lot of other people online. We have Cam Leonard from the Attorney General's Office, Lynn Kent, Director of Water Division, DEC, Doug Willover from the Alaska court system, and Tom Crawford from DNR online at the present time, too.
I don't have any questions for any of them, but I do have one question for the sponsor, and I would hope if we're going to move the bill, you know, unless people have a lot to add, we can just do it. I'd like the members and the sponsor to look at subsection C1. The existence of security under section B of this section does not prohibit a person who's wrongly enjoined or restrained from obtaining relief that may be available to that person. Um, And that sub 2 seems clearly to apply to either party to the litigation, any party, limit the amount that a party may recover in the action. I'm just wondering, I would feel more comfortable if sub 1 would say prohibit a party. Well, I think this would take more than that, and I'm not prepared to offer an amendment in this committee. But at some point, the sponsor and others who look at the bill might want to look a little bit at C1 to be sure that that applies to any party. I mean, obviously, if you're enjoined, you're going to be prevented from violating the injunction. But I just want to be sure that the bill is fair and even-handed on both sides. And I'm sorry, folks, I just noticed this a minute ago, and I'm not going to hold up the bill or do anything. But I think that at some point, and I'm happy to work with you if you'd like, to make certain that C1 operates fairly to all parties, and I'll just leave that comment on the record.
Further questions from committee members? I do have a little bit of concern with the way some of it is written. If the court determines payment of wages is determined as part of the security, how do the workers whose wages were not paid getting paid for those lost wages? Or would the security deposit go to the company, or would the employees get paid directly? I mean, this is something that is a little not clear here. And I don't know if we should ask Doug Wolliver or somebody in that. Mr. Wolliver, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. This is Doug Wolliver with the Alaska Court System.
Yes, did you hear my question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. If the bond is posted on behalf of, well, to protect the interests of the company who's alleging that they may have some lost wages, the court will, if the bond is forfeited, the court would pay that bond amount to the party that was enjoined. The court wouldn't have a way of knowing who the company should then reimburse for lost wages and things. That would be up to the company who received the forfeited bond.
Doesn't that bring some suspicion into the process as far as the company pocketing and not paying anybody any wages?
Mr. Chairman, I suppose a company could do that. But as I say, the court end of things, they're not going to have any of that information, so it would be up to the party to reimburse any both employees and subcontractors.
Sure.
Representative Grunberg has a question.
I think maybe to answer your question.
Yes.
Mr. Wolliver, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I would think that if the bond were subsequently forfeited, that the company that received the money would legally hold it in constructive trust, that's a term of art, for the employees or whoever the beneficiaries would be. A constructive trust is not like a trust document, but it's an equitable device that's used for somebody who gets money or another asset on behalf of somebody else. And the court could, as part of the order exonerating the bond, make that clear that it's held in constructive trust and even require that it be sequestered. It would seem to be that the employees or a union or somebody representing them would be able to ask to have that done to make certain that the company did not take advantage of the situation and abscond with their money.
So that would have to be done by the court at the time of the final judgment?
Yeah, I would think so. I think they'd have a right to intervene for that purpose. Through the chair, Mr. Woolover, do you feel you can comment on that one?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I suspect the court probably could at least state on the record that there's some type of constructive trust, although I could see a potential, anyway, a further litigation over who was reimbursed to what extent and who was, you know, really owed the money. The bond, remember, will be likely be a portion of, or it may very well be a portion of all of those costs and fees and benefits and subcontract costs. And how that all gets apportioned with a forfeited bond could get somewhat complicated.
Representative Gruenberg.
The device, and it's covered in another rule that can be used in a situation like this, is if there is a bond and the injunction is dissolved and the corporation is deemed to get the bond back, that the bonding company, if another claim were made, can do what's called put it into the registry of the court, and then it's called an interpleader action, and the parties could then go before the court and ask the court to enter appropriate orders as to who gets that bond. So there are other rules. It's kind of complicated, but there are rules to achieve justice in a case like that.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee of the sponsor or any of the people we have online that are available to answer questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Feige. Representative Feige. do we have any of the other witnesses on online or in the room like to testify to House Bill 168? Okay, hearing none, we will close public testimony. We have that one. We're done there. Well, what is the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move it, if you mind.
Go right ahead.
HB 168 version Bravo with accompanying fiscal note zero, I guess it is, and the individual recommendations from committee.
Pardon?
As amended.
As amended. As amended. Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, we move House Bill 168 from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. We'll see if we're still working. We're back on the record. Our next order of business is House Bill 1, Policy for Securing Health Care Services, sponsored by Representative Gatto. And here to present House Bill 1 is Karen Sawyer, staff to Representative Gatto.
I motion that we bring CSHB 1 version R before the committee for discussion.
I have a B.
Version B.
Is it B?
Yep.
Probably is.
I gave you the wrong script.
Oh, yeah. We have an objection for discussion purposes.
Yeah.
We do. Okay. Ms. Sawyer, please place your name on the affiliation on the record and give us the committee a brief refresher on HB 1 and the changes in the new CS.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Sawyer, and I'm staff to Representative Carl Gatto. And on Friday, the committee heard the bill for the first time and recommended a couple changes in the language. If you look on the work draft, page 1 in the title, it was changed from choose to accept. Mm-hmm. And inserted offered. And the same wording was changed on line 9 and 10, where it says the person has the right to accept instead of choose, and included on line 10 the word offered. And those are the changes for the CS.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. All right. Seeing none, then we are addressing the CS for House Bill 1. You want to give us a little refresher on the bill, please?
The bill is about the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, PPACA, which is going to make a mandate that all individuals, U.S. individuals, by, you know, whether you're a citizen or a legal resident, that you must have qualifying health care insurance or pay a tax penalty. And this bill says that the federal government does not have that right to penalize an individual for not acting on a federal mandate. It's not their position to do that. And so this bill allows, it takes away that penalty coverage, and it says that individuals can either accept it or decline the health care coverage and insurance, and they will not be penalized. And a person can choose to just pay for the health care services themselves, and that particular payment to the health care provider will not be a penalty. That was a CS from Hess.
I got a little confused in reading this several times and was trying to determine, you know, it addresses offering a mode of securing health care services and then defines any modes of securing health care services and health care services or the purchase of insurance to cover the cost of health care services. Seemed like this is an insurance type bill, but we're covering health care services in here that kind of throws the confusion at me. You know, we're talking insurance, not a health care service that's being provided over here on the other side of it.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the way it's worded is because the PPACA is going to mandate or have certain health care services available under their plan, which is going to be made possible by the government. It's going to be their directive about health care services, what we can choose and what we cannot, and what type of services will be available under this act. So that's why we're concerned that individuals will still be able to choose the health care services that they want to and not have to receive just what the government tells them that they can receive. PPACA limits what health care services will be available.
Representative Holmes. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I share some of your confusion here. I don't think that the Affordable Care Act limits the options that are available. I'm sharing your concern that on a couple things. One is, you know, if what we're really going after is insurance, but what we're talking about is mode of obtaining health care,
yeah,
those don't seem to line up very well, and I'm still. Last week we went down a few trails of trying to get at what is and isn't going to be affected by this, and I'm just afraid that this is going after that the stated goal and the language of the bill don't quite line up, and that kind of concerns me, that we talk about the stated goal is to say that you can't be required to have health care insurance, but I'm not entirely sure that's what the bill says. And that makes me kind of nervous as to what we might unwittingly be, all the unintended consequences that might come with this bill.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, this bill was modeled after the ALEC model of legislation, which is being used across the country. So I don't have an explanation for that terminology that was used. I can certainly look into that and get back to the committee members.
If I could have a second.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what happens to this bill if the U.S. Supreme Court decides that actually the Affordable Care Act provisions are constitutional?
Well, this, through the chair, Representative Holmes, this bill is written as if PPACA will be accepted as constitutional, so that we have this in place in case, so that when the federal government mandates an individual coverage through PPACA, then this bill will be in place.
But if I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, if we have a statute that's directly in conflict with a federal law that's been found to be constitutional, then isn't this null and void anyway and irrelevant? Either the Supreme Court's going to find that the provisions are unconstitutional, and then we won't need the law, or the Supreme Court will find out that it is constitutional, and then this law is all null and void. So isn't this sort of a lot of yelling and screaming with no actual effect?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, it's hard to say what's going to happen with that because we're still waiting for the appeal process, and I believe that the number of states, which is over 40 right now, that have either had this bill go through and is law now in their state, or it's still in the process. We're hoping that all of this will show attention to the fact that there are a number of states that do not agree that the federal government can mandate a state that's a state's rights, not a federal mandate, because they're taxing or penalizing people for not doing something. And so we just want to make this message known, and hopefully there will be some action on that.
We have somebody online that could possibly answer this also. We have Sign Anderson from the Attorney General's Office. Are you there?
Yes, I am. It's Signe Anderson.
Yes. Would you please place yourself on the record, give us your affiliation, and can you answer this question for us?
My name is Signe Anderson. I'm from the Attorney General's Office. And I think it's hard to predict what's going to happen in the future with respect to the litigation and the legal landscape at that time. I mean, obviously, if the mandate or the PPAC is upheld at the Supreme Court, I think federal preemption becomes an issue, but I'm not prepared at this time to say that this bill would have no effect.
Representative Holmes, have you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, that makes me even more nervous, because if the Supreme Court were to strike down the provision, and obviously when we talk about the Affordable Care Act, I think that the section we're mostly talking about is the one that requires people to buy insurance. But so if the Supreme Court were to strike that down as unconstitutional, then it would no longer be in effect, but we would still have this bill in effect. So then what would this bill do? That's what makes me nervous, and I think what maybe makes the chair nervous is that what else is this bill going to cover? Because I guess I just see this, we've already, if the whole point is to make a statement that we don't believe that this is allowed, the governor and the attorney general have already sued on this bill. So what more statement do we need? We're already parties to the lawsuit. I think that's the statement. Putting a law on the books that is purported to only address that issue, but is written a lot more broadly and talks about healthcare services in general, we could end up in the position where that bill is struck down and we still have this law on our books and now we don't know what exactly it addresses. Or, alternatively, it's upheld, but, portions of this are struck down. Anyway, this makes me nervous because I think it's not very narrowly tailored to do what it's purporting to do, and I'm afraid that we're going to end up with a law on our books that does other things that we can't quite define right now.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Grunberg.
I share, Mr. Chair, thank you. I share some of those concerns. I mean, I share those concerns as well. My question, I have several.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of come from to that point, but a little bit different. And this is, and I see we have several people from Department of Health and Social Services here. My
yes.
question's first, not in order of importance. It's very, very unusual, and this really goes to Ms. Foster. It's very, very unusual to have a short title of a bill. I think this may come about once every legislator, if that, maybe just one time. Is there a reason you need a short title? Because otherwise I'll move to strike the short title. We just don't do it.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't know why it's a short title. I'm not sure what else you would add to it.
No, I just delete section one.
Oh, I see.
We normally do not, particularly
oh, I see
statement
what you're
of
saying.
Policy. Yeah. Unless there's some huge issue, and I can't think. We must have had some. Maybe somebody else remembers. Oh, yeah, oh, interstate compacts, uniform acts. To be a uniform act like Uniform Commercial Code, you have to have a short title. That's required. And compacts, you have to have a title. But other than that, we just don't do it. Would the sponsor have an objection if we struck title, section one?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, since the sponsor is not here, I can't speak for him, so I would have to.
Through the chair, I'd like you to check, because there have been individual legislators in the past who served in this body who like to do short titles, and they're not around anymore, and we would struggle on short titles, and I don't want to go down that road if we can avoid it. That's number one. Number two, and this is a question to Ms. Anderson from the Department of Law. And this deals with line 14 on page one of the bill. The policy does not impair, may not impair a contract right that provides health care services. If there is some kind of federal law that passes, or some kind of a federal requirement that somebody have or purchase health insurance, it seems to me as a matter of law that federal requirement that somebody purchases insurance would become part of the contract, that because federal law requires it, it would become an implied in law provision in the contract. Ms. Anderson, do you understand what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg, I think I understand your question, but I'm not sure I can answer it. I don't know the body of federal jurisprudence, whether or not, I don't know if that would be required or implied into a contract. I know, for example, under state law, if we passed a law that mandated a particular benefit, we have a provision in the insurance code that would actually interpret or imply that term or whatever that benefit or requirement is into the contract. But I haven't researched that issue specifically with respect to federal law.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is generally legally correct, but we're not sure in this case if that would apply because of the particular federal laws involved. And I guess that I think that that's something that needs to be addressed, because if in fact, and I'm going to use the term although I don't like it, Obamacare, whatever the name of the thing is, does have that requirement, then it may very well meet the requirements of subsection 2, and this policy would be inapplicable if that were the case.
All right, further questions from the committee? We also have present here John Sherwood from the Department of Health and Social Services. Did you have any question? Would you like him to come forward?
Yes, please.
Mr. Sherwood, would you please come forward and place your name and affiliation on the record? And looks like we have a question or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. One, do you have any concerns about this bill having any negative effects on any other federal programs such as Medicare, Medicaid? I mean, are there any I guess all my questions are going to go back to this question that you, Mr. Chairman, and I were asking, which is sort of, we know what the stated intent is of the sponsor, but the language in front of us, what other areas could we kind of unwittingly be getting off into?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I can't speak to Medicare as it's a federal program. We aren't involved in the administration. With regard to the state and state and federal programs like Medicaid, I specifically asked the Department of Law whether they believe the language on page 1 in lines 11 through 13 was adequate for our purposes, including I asked the question with regard to child support enforcement, as that's kind of a linked requirement with Medicaid and some of our other assistance programs. And they assured me that the language was adequate for the purpose of administering our programs.
Okay. So. Follow up, go right ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. How about, I mean, I'm just sort of struggling with this whole thing that it deals with modes of obtaining healthcare services. And I'm struggling with what else. I'm just struggling with that language.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I am not the expert on PPACA, but my understanding is the tax penalty applies to someone who doesn't have health insurance or who does not have some other form of means of obtaining health care. For instance, the Indian Health Service is exempt, and that wouldn't necessarily be considered insurance. As a lay person, that was my understanding of why both of those references were there. But again, I'm not the drafter or the sponsor, so I don't want to impute intent.
Thank you. And I'm not sure how much more we're going to get on this, Mr. Chairman. But I just am really, you know, I'm really struggling with the right to accept or decline any offered mode of health care services. What sorts of things might be out there that might be contrary to public policy or contrary to law? I mean, somebody offers me health care and I'm allowed under this without penalty to accept it, even if maybe it's something that's illegal under state law. Maybe it's a drug that hasn't been approved, or maybe it's a procedure that hasn't been approved, or somebody who's not licensed who's offering me a mode of obtaining health care, and this says I'm free to accept or decline it without any penalty or threat of penalty. I'm sort of wondering how this might interact with some of our criminal or other penalty provisions. So I say, oh, well, sure, you know, I like that. I want to use that illegal drug for my health care. I don't know. I'm just, the language is, I'm struggling with it. I'm not sure that's a question for you, though, so if I were you, I'd just duck.
Mr. Sherwood, I can ask some other questions here yet, too.
All right.
No, I have a clarification for Representative Lindsay.
Go ahead, Representative Keller.
Hey, you please run that by me again. What are you saying? I'm really struggling with trying to understand what it is that you're afraid of allowing a prisoner, an example you use, to accept or decline.
Yeah, no, I'll try to be clear. So here's sort of the hypothetical that under this language. It says that I, being a person, you know, in the state of Alaska, I have the right to accept or decline any offered mode of obtaining health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. What I'm wondering is if that doesn't allow me, as an Alaskan, to, for instance, say that I'm free to use, for instance, let's say scheduled narcotics, you know, that without a prescription. I think that I've got, you know, I'm in pain, and, you know, somebody offers me OxyContin, and I don't have a prescription for it, but somebody offers it to me. Am I allowed to accept that without penalty or threat of penalty? That's the kind of thing I'm trying to get to here, is what does this language, I understand that's not at all the intent of the bill, but intent is one thing and language is another. So what I'm trying to figure out is what are the unintended consequences of this bill? Are we setting it up such that people could do things like that, engage in, you know, procedures that are illegal, engage in, I mean, all sorts of illegal I hate to even go there, but I don't know, all sorts of illegal both procedures and drugs without penalty or threat of penalty. Does that make it clear where my
thank you for the
going?
Opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I won't go on the debate bill now. Yeah. I just wanted a clarification,
yeah.
and I have plenty to say, but I want to respect to the chair. It's all yours.
Yeah, it's healthcare service instead of insurance. You know, the right to accept or decline any offered mode of obtaining healthcare service without penalty or threat of penalty. I mean, that's what's kind of confusing. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for you, Mr. Shorth, through the chair.
Go right ahead.
This is a bill that's unusual. The text of the bill is unusual because it is a policy. And a policy is almost like a legislative intent section. And if sometimes this kind of a provision, if there were a substantive bill connected with it, would just be in legislative intent. And, Karen, you can correct me if I'm wrong. When we say policy, that's like saying, through the chair, if I may have a little leeway, that's like saying it's the intent of the legislature, right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not. I don't know if I can speak to how the drafters use the words.
All right. Well, that would be this representative's interpretation, that it's like saying this is the legislative intent, and so if you have a legislative intent or a policy set out, and we have like some. In natural resources, we have natural resources, some legislation that is the policy. There are statutes like this. But I don't think, and this is a long preamble to a short question, so bear with me. It's like saying, this is how we'd like other laws or other issues to be interpreted. At least that's the way I read this. How will that actually work in effect in the department's conduct of its day-to-day business? Because the department is not in the business of determining people's rights. That's more an issue for the courts. And maybe I'll ask this question also to Mr. Woolover. But this is just going to be hanging out there. And that there's a legislative policy that there is a right. But it's not a, unless some court says somewhere, it's not a constitutional right at this point. And is there a statutory right that this is connected with? How will you interpret this thing? What does it do?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, by and large, the programs I work with are exempted from the provisions of this bill. Under the language in page 1, 11 through 13. The programs we do offer are generally authorized in statute, so that would be our first point of reference in terms of how we would administer the programs. As I read and as I've had discussions with the Department of Law, we would not be bound by this policy because of the exception requirements for healthcare services. I would say that generally where we know that there has been an establishment of state policy, all other things being equal, we would try and respect state policy. But again, we would be working within the constraints of our authorizing statutes, the constraints of whatever federal statutes or federal funding agreements were involved in the programs we operated. We do not anticipate that this would have any direct effect on our department. That's one reason why we have the zero fiscal note. But so probably day to day, this would have very little impact on my department's operation. I cannot speak for other departments and some of the activities they're engaged with for example, the regulation of health insurance in the Department of Commerce. I wouldn't be able to speak to that.
Maybe I could ask the same question.
Representative Grunberg, go ahead.
Karen, the representative for the bill sponsor, what is the sponsor's intent that this bill will do?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the simple answer is just that we do not believe that an individual should be mandated by the federal government to obtain, to purchase something, that it's mandated that they must do that, and it takes away their individual right. And for them to be penalized if they choose not to, then we feel that that is another error, that the government can't penalize an individual for not doing something.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up, Representative Grunberg.
But that's a question of federal law, isn't it? And federal constitutional law. The first question is, what does the federal law do? Because indisputably, if the federal law mandates something or prevents something, the supremacy clause requires that the state honor that, unless the federal constitution prohibits it.
You're revving my motor, sir.
As a former helicopter pilot, let's make sure you don't decircle. You see what I'm saying? We don't have any control either over federal law or the federal constitution. Those are issues ultimately for the federal courts. Shouldn't this be, with all due respect, more a House joint resolution urging the federal government to change the federal law, or urging the state to challenge it or something, which they're doing? I mean, I don't think that this has any authority. We can't have the kind of effect on federal law and the federal constitution that you're saying you want this bill to have.
Well, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we just believe, as other states do, that this is not an area of the federal constitution the federal government, they cannot make this mandate. That is a state's rights to govern health care insurance, and this, from what my understanding, from what I've read, this is the first time that this has ever happened where there's been a penalty implied for non-action. So we just believe that it's the state's rights to allow their citizens to choose, and this is not something that the government should be mandating. And there's a number of people across the country that believe this as well. So, and I would like to also just make a mention, Representative Holmes, through the chair. You were concerned about the health care regarding illegal products or services, and in the description of mode of obtaining, it says directly purchasing from a health care provider. And I think that clarifies that, you know, the mode of obtaining is from an actual health care provider, not just somebody from the street.
Okay, is there any further questions of the administration or from the sponsor? I'd like to thank Ms. Anderson and Mr. Sherwood for your testimony. We will open this up now for public testimony. And online we have Pat Luby from Anchorage. Are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you give your name and affiliation for the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Sure. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. AARP opposes House Bill Number 1. Obviously, many well-meaning people have opposing positions on the federal health care reform, especially the individual mandate. However, for years, we've had citizens decide not to secure health insurance. In some cases, they were young people who figured they would never get sick or be in an accident, what the insurance industry called the invincibles. But we also had other older people who, for whatever reason, could not secure coverage. For example, AARP's membership starts at age 50. In Alaska, 19% of the 50 to 64-year-olds are uninsured, one out of five. When one of the young invincibles has a car accident or a skiing mishap, they end up in the emergency room with no insurance. When an uninsured 58-year-old is sick and has no primary care provider, he ends up in the emergency room. Neither one has insurance, but someone picks up the tab. It's split between all those patients who do show up with an insurance card. It's estimated that every Alaska family with insurance spends another $1,900 per year to pay the cost of the uninsured. Private employers who provide insurance pick up the cost of the uninsured. Our largest employer, the state of Alaska, picks up some of those shifted costs. PERS and TERS pick up some of those costs. Medicaid will pick up some of those costs. Medicare is going to pick up some of those costs. The federal judge who made the last comments in Washington, D.C. In favor of supporting the bill indicated that, and she used the term free riders, and I think that's a good example of what we have. Not everyone is intentionally a free rider. Some people simply can't afford insurance. And the new health insurance program under the federal government has subsidies for people, significant subsidies. But removing the individual mandate will only continue this practice of cost shifting. On March 1st, I testified before Representative Keller's HES committee, and I told a story there about something that had happened to one of our staff person's relatives down in Sitka. He's a commercial fisherman. He's married. He has two children. He has no health insurance. He fell 28 feet onto the deck of his boat. He ended up getting sent to trauma hospital in Seattle. He's been there ever since. All of us are going to end up picking up some of his tab. If he was mandated to at least have minimum health insurance, and if he couldn't afford it, it would have been subsidized, the insurance company would end up picking up the bill, as they rightfully should. Instead, all those costs are going to be shifted to the rest of us. Simply because of this reason of cost shifting, AARP request a no vote on House Bill 1. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Luby, Representative Keller has a question.
Thank you for your testimony, Pat. I understand from your testimony that you believe that it's okay and it's proper that everybody be mandated to purchase insurance, whether or not it's subsidized or not. I mean, in other words, you agree with what is going on here with Obamacare.
Yes, Representative Keller. We don't believe that this is going to work unless everyone participates in the program. That's the whole purpose of group health insurance.
So, please, yes or no, do you agree that everybody ought to be mandated to have insurance?
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative.
Okay, does AARP sell insurance?
Yes, yeah, through the chair, yes, Representative. We have a Medicare supplement.
And will that change if Obamacare goes into effect? Will you still be selling insurance? Will you sell more insurance or less insurance?
Through the chair, I don't know. We don't get into that side of AARP's business. That's a for-profit corporation that AARP has that does business with other businesses. I don't think anyone knows what the impact will be. With Medicare, most older people buy some type of a Medicare supplement now. Over 90% of older people who have Medicare buy some type of a supplement to cover that other 20% that Medicare doesn't pay.
Yeah, and thank you, Pat. And I was just suggesting that there may be a conflict of interest there in your testimony because of that thing. Also, it occurred to me, the second time I heard a story, you know, about the man who fell and how the cost is transferred onto all of us. Isn't that the case whether somebody is insured or not insured? I mean, if somebody is uninsured, then it gets passed around to all of us anyway, right? So I was just wondering about that.
If you have insurance, Representative Keller, then the entire group shares some of that bill. And if it is a real expensive case, as this man's will be, you could even have an insurance company that is going to have to raise rates for everybody simply because of one or two real expensive cases. But the more people that purchase insurance, the larger the group gets, the less it's going to cost all of us when someone does have a real terrible accident like that.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out that because people who are covered by Medicare, they have insurance, so they would be exempted. So a Medicare supplement shouldn't be affected because all the people who are on Medicare are already considered to have insurance.
All right. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Luby, for your testimony. Is anybody else online or in the room that would like to testify to House Bill 1? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Because there are some questions about the short title, also questions that weren't answered from the Attorney General's office, if we could get some written testimony on that. I'm going to set this House Bill 1 aside for the return of the sponsor, Representative Gatto. So we'll move on now.
Could I add one?
Yeah, Representative Keller had one more comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, because I think there's a lot of things that were brought out in the questioning that were beyond questions and they were statements. And I just wanted to, just for thought for the next time around here, the different modes of obtaining health care, it occurs to me that one mode would be if, like, a group that has a group insurance plan in a business or whatever, and they hire their own doctors, it wouldn't be an insurance plan. There's a lot of different options here. So let's say you're in a company, and the company has its own doctors, and they provide you, it's a whole spectrum, and they provide you with health care services. What the question of the bill proposes is that can be accepted and declined by the people in that work for the person. So, but yeah, and I think we also, I just need to make one quick comment on the discussions that were out there on the federal law versus state law. I just want to remind everybody that the federal government was created by the states. It wasn't the other way around.
Right.
And there's a point there. This debate has been going on for 200 and X number of years since our country was founded, but it's not a question of, the question is still there, is what we do as a state, as a sovereign, we have a legislature, we have a form of government, whether or not we should make laws based on what's good for our citizens and how to respond to the federal government is not that cut and dried, but personally for one, you know, I just, because of the comments that are on the record, I mean, personally for one, I would like us to stand up for what we're making the right policy for the state of Alaska.
And if we could get a response from the Attorney General's office, should a Supreme Court decision come down, how would that affect this bill? We'd sure appreciate it. Okay, our final order of business today is House Bill 6, Removing a Regent. Is sponsored by Representative Grunberg. Here to present House Bill 6 is Representative Grunberg and his aide, Ted Madsen. There is a CS for House Bill 6 that needs to be introduced. Representative Pruitt.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to bring CS for House HB 6 version R before the committee for discussion.
I'll object for a discussion.
Okay, we have an objection. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Max Grunberg, representative from House District 20, and to do the honors today, we have Ted Madsen of my staff, with your permission.
Mr. Madsen, please place yourself on the record, and we'll have your testimony, or your presentation, I mean.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ted Madsen, staff to Representative Max Grunberg. Thank you very much for hearing this bill this afternoon. There are three changes between the T version and the R version of House Bill 6. Currently, the committee substitute that you have before you is version R. There is one change to page 2. It is on line 21, and that is changing the phrase a complaint to an accusation. And this is conforming to the language that the Department of Law uses with regards to the Personnel Board, and Ms. Judy Bachman can better define that phrasing than I will be able to. The second change is on page 3, lines 17 through 18. The phrase that results in a recommendation of removal under AS 39.52.410B3 was added because this is the we did not intend for any violation of the Executive Branch Ethics Act to be cause for removal, but ones that result in a recommendation of removal, the most serious violations are what we are looking for. And finally, Mr. Chair, we added the phrase to serve for an extended period of time on line 27 of page 3 of the R version. This was in response to Representative Lynn's concerns that an inability to serve for one meeting was not necessarily grounds for removal. With that, Mr. Chair, those are the three changes to the bill from the previous draft.
Questions from the committee on the suggested changes?
Mr. Chairman, if there are no other questions, I will remove my objection.
Okay. See, hearing no objections, then we will be addressing the CS for House Bill number 6. And if you want to give us a little recap and refresher on House Bill 6, please.
Who are we?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 6 is in response to a number of concerns. It was started in 2007 when a member of the Board of Regents faced many federal felony indictments for various charges of fraud and embezzlement. At the time, the various committees of the legislature asked for the Board of Regents to explain themselves, understanding what the procedures were for removal of a regent. There were no procedures for the removal of a regent, and since that time, the Board of Regents has not drafted procedures for removal of one of their own. And this bill would both insulate the university from any sort of cloud of suspicion and also guarantee that the university is still free from political pressure, because removal and suspension is only in cases of good cause.
All right. Also online today to answer questions on this bill, we have Judy Bachman from the Department of Law and Jean Michelle, the drafter from Legislative Legal. Questions from committee members? Representative Keller.
This is related to conceptual amendment R.1. I won't move it at this time. I just want to ask the sponsor. The reasons for removing a regent are limited to cause that originates from the regent. There's no room left, and there's no allowance made, I guess, for making the decision to remove a regent for the good of the university. And I would just like to understand, why. If I am thinking about, for example, the State Board of Education, as I understand that, I'm not real sure if the current status is that they serve at the pleasure of the governor, if that's been repealed, but I do know that there's more power there for the governor to get rid of at least I believe that's true, a state board on the state board member. And I was just wondering why the difference and why you have limited it to cause that originates from the region.
Thank you. May I respond?
Representative Grunberg, respond.
Yeah, we have both Jean Michelle and Judy Bachman, two other lawyers, and would ask that they correct me with the chair's permission if I'm wrong. Because the Board of Regents is constitutionally different. The university is set up as a separate constitutional entity under the state constitution. The other boards and commissions are under whatever this, if I may use this, they're under the provision in the Constitution dealing with the executive branch, which gives the governor the authority to remove them and in a manner that is prescribed by law. The executive branch, and I'm talking here about Article 3, Section 26, when a board or commission is at the head of a principal department or a regulatory or quasi-judicial agency, its members shall be appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session, et cetera. The board or commission may appoint principal executive officer, subject to the approval of the governor. The university, though, is in a separate constitutional branch of government and is not subject to that. The provisions here, though, relate to the and there's a legal opinion here, the inherent authority to set up a procedure for good cause. Otherwise, the only way of potentially removing somebody would be by impeachment, which is cumbersome and not workable during the majority of the year. And we have a legal opinion that specifically states that. And the thing that I'm concerned about, and you and I have talked through the chair, you and I have talked about Amendment R1, and I am very concerned that this would basically subject to the Board of Regents to potential political pressure and political interpretation in what the good of the university would be in the eyes of the governor when that's a constitutionally separate branch of government, and that it would be subject to constitutional challenge for that reason. I think that this, my personal view, is that Amendment R1 would likely be found unconstitutional, and I sure don't want to go down that road.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it okay if I ask a question of our legal services on the same point?
Yes, we have on the online Judy Bachman and Jean Michelle.
Well, I was thinking Jean Michelle, but either one, either or. If the committee were to choose to allow, as a matter of policy, the removal of a regent by the governor for the good of the university, would that pass constitutional muster, in your opinion?
Either one of you like to reply to that question?
This is Jean Michelle with the Legal Services Office, the legislature. As I understand the proposed amendment, that would be the, is that, through the chair, Representative Keller, is that the, are there any limitations you're placing on the governor, or it's just a blanket statement that they,
actually, the we haven't proposed the amendment yet, so we're just talking in general about the bill, I believe.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad we haven't proposed the amendment, because for me it was questions about the bill, and it may not be the appropriate amendment at all. And part of the reason I am proposing it is to get those answers. And I would like in your answer to describe a process that we could put in an amendment form that would not violate the Constitution, that would give more power to the governor and or the legislature as far as that goes, not as a matter of, I'm not as concerned with the political pressure as I am. I have a desire for balance of power and balance on what goes on here. So is there a way to remove a regent in someone's determination by some process because of some wrong that the regent is accused of doing?
Through the chair, this is Jean Michelle again with Legal Services. Yes, there is a way. You mentioned impeachment. That's one option. In my opinion, and I've expressed this elsewhere, currently there's an implied authority to remove by the governor any Board of Regents. That I understand that opinion is debatable, but there is nothing in the current case law or in the Constitution that would prohibit the governor from removing a regent under the governor's inherent appointment authority. There is some discussion, I understand, on the from the part of the attorney general from the attorney general's office that they disagree that the governor may currently remove without further authority a regent without cause. So that leaves open the question of whether or not a governor may remove a regent without cause without further authority. But your options are to clarify that point in statute and risk a constitutional challenge under separation of powers concern, or to amend the Constitution to clarify Article 7, Section 3, to allow for removal as provided by law, as is the case with executive boards that head up agencies.
Any follow-up questions on from the committee on that? Ms. Michelle, out of curiosity, I mean, your argument here is pretty clear, but does the governor support this bill?
Through the Mr. Chair, I can't answer that question.
Okay,
maybe you want to ask.
I think that the Department of Law could probably answer that for you.
We have the Department of Law.
Yes, we do. Judy Bachman, are you online?
Yes, sir. But I'll have to acknowledge that this question is far beyond my knowledge and expertise, as I'm just here to answer questions regarding the relationship of the couple of changes dealing with the Ethics Act, and I have never looked into these constitutional issues regarding the University Board of Regents, and so I'm not the appropriate Assistant Attorney General to address that question. I apologize.
Well, out of curiosity, either one of you, would the passage of House Bill 6 allow the governor to immediately give him immediate authority to suspend a regent and have that suspension remain in effect until the regent is cleared in a hearing?
To the chair, this is Judy Bachman again. I haven't studied this bill enough to be able to answer that question. As I said, my role has been very limited.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Your question, sir, was would the bill allow the governor to suspend a regent pending a regent's request for a hearing? Is that the question?
Well, yeah, that's it. Until the regent is cleared in the hearing, so it would let him suspend him pending a hearing.
That is correct. There are two ways. If certain things would be terms for an immediate removal. And those things, for example, would be an inability to serve, or if they had been convicted of a felony. If they were indicted, let's say, then the governor would have the authority, if the governor wished, to suspend the regent. The governor can proceed in either of two ways. The governor could file the accusation and then transmit the file to the Office of Administrative Hearings and have a hearing before the suspension. Alternatively, the governor could suspend, and then the burden would be on the regent, or the burden of going forward, not the burden of persuasion, but the burden of going forward to request the hearing would then be on the regent, and the regent would simply request a hearing, and they would hold the hearing and make that determination. So if the governor proceeded that way, then the regent would be suspended and listen until the hearing was held, and the hearing found that the requirements of the law were not met. To answer your earlier question about the governor's position, the governor there's not a fiscal note as to what the governor's position. In the past, though, I talked with Governor Palin about this when she was in office and we first did the bill, and they detailed an Assistant Attorney General, Mike Barnhill, who did most of the drafting on this, and they were very involved in this from the beginning.
All right.
That was a different administration, but nobody has come up and said anything to me on this one.
Okay. Further questions from Representative Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gruenberg, do you, I don't want to put words in your mouth there. I just want to understand. Are you not open or are you not positive to the idea of expanding or including in your bill a means to remove a regent that where a, you know, it is for the considered by somebody's by some process to be the good of the university that a regent be removed? You want to keep it limited to the cause originating from the regent. I just want to clarify to find out if you're willing to work on something that would give a balance of power, or if that is something that is, you know, absolutely against your intent for the bill.
Yes and no. Number one, I think both from a policy point of view, because these are different branches of government, and from a constitutional law point of view, because I don't want to go to the edge of the envelope on the bill, that there have to be something specifically set out in the bill so that there not be a vague and standardless delegation of authority. That's the term that's used. Now, as to the language that you had suggested, the good of the university, that, I think, goes beyond the area that I'm comfortable with. What we do have here, and some people have said maybe we've gone too far, but I'm willing to go to this extent. Hopefully it will get you to an area that you can be comfortable with, is, and I'm looking here, where we define on page 3, line 25, malfeasance or nonfeasance in office. Misconduct is more of an objective standard. A neglect of duty, incompetence, unjustifiable failure to perform the duties, misconduct related to the ability to serve as a regent, but that results in a suspension or revocation of the license. Those kinds of things, first of all, would require some kind of a nexus, a finding that the regent had done or failed to do something. And secondly, that action or failure to perform was connected with the duty of the regent. In other words, the university itself. You couldn't just said, this guy has 27 speeding tickets that they haven't paid. So, and the good of the university or something like that would allow a governor to impose his or her political will if he felt he didn't like the direction that the university was taking or didn't like the fact that they wouldn't support scholarships for additional football players or something like that. That, I think, would be unwise and probably unconstitutional. But with the caveat that it's the performance or failure to perform and that relate to the duties of the regent, I think that is the heart of the phrase good of the university.
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative Keller has a follow-up.
I think your answer was no, and I am still processing that. It seems to me that it is not just political. Political pressure is not always bad when you're talking about balancing power with the executive and or the legislative branch as far as what our university is doing and standing for. So respectfully, I'm just processing that. And my inclination is to want to, in fact, allow debate. Debate is a healthy thing. We're doing it right now. When you get too much authority vested in the Board of Regents and we can have no input, I'm uncomfortable with that. You know, and I'm not stuck on giving the governor broad powers, but I would like to see a means where we're engaged also. Legislature is engaged also. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, reply.
I think this is in some ways similar to the relationship between the executive branch and the judiciary. Once the governor appoints a judge, the governor's authority over that judge is gone, and what we have there is a different method of dealing with it. The Commission on Judicial Conduct is the way and that the Supreme Court disciplines the members of the judiciary. But we don't have a commission on the regents, and I think setting up something like that for however many regents doesn't make a lot of sense. But those are both co-equal branches, and it's much more narrow, of course, with the university. But this just has, I think there has to be some method that we can deal with a regent who has a serious problems like the region in Fairbanks did. I never would have expected that, and it's something that fortunately is not going to happen very often, I don't believe, but I think there should be something in place now so we don't agonize for months figuring what to do. It's a question of getting, it may not be perfect, but I think we need to get something done.
Thank you for the leeway and asking the questions. I'll wait until you.
Yes, Representative Keller. Okay, do we have any further questions of the sponsor or Ted? Representative Keller has three conceptual amendments. Representative Keller.
Can I ask what the intent is? I would respectfully request that we not move the bill today. Chair decides, I will refrain from R1, offering that one, because it is too broad. As the sponsor has pointed out very well, and I agree with him, I would move conceptual amendment R.2. That has not been discussed, and maybe there's something I do not see here, but what it is on page 2, line 14, after the word suspend, put in the words with or without pay. The rationale is that...
Can we have an objection?
Representative
Pruitt objects for discussion purposes. Go ahead, Representative Keller.
Thank you. I was on a roll. I'm sorry.
You were on a roll.
After the word suspend on page 2, line 14, add the words with or without pay. And the scenario that I'm envisioning in making this suggestion is if we have an egregious, accusation and perception out there may be related to finances, that it may be very significant to be able to do this. The reason I hesitated here is I was thinking about how this would look without my amendment and with my amendment, but
okay.
I'm not real sure if it,
Mr. Madsen, do you have a reply on that for Representative Keller?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Keller, I spoke with a receptionist at the Board of Regents, and the members of the Board of Regents do not receive pay. They receive per diem for when they travel to a meeting of the Board of Regents, and if they are suspended, I believe they would not be receiving per diem because they would not be allowed to attend.
I withdraw amendment number 2.
All right. Amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. Representative Keller.
What?
Do you have another?
No, that's it. I had a conceptual amendment on R.3, but it was conceptually tied to R.1, so it will not be offering R.3.
All right. Any further questions of the sponsor or any discussion? Anybody wishing to testify under public testimony? Nobody online? Anybody in the audience? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Further discussion by the committee on House Bill 6.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion?
Yes, I would entertain a motion. Go right ahead.
With due respect, I'm going to make a motion to move with individual recommendations you may or subject. I would hope that the bill would move. It's been around this committee for political reasons unrelated to anything today that I can figure out for several years. I'd like to see us get this in place, and it's going to be important to try to get it across to the other body this year. Otherwise, it's going to be yet another year, and I would hope that you could remove your objections to the movement and vote the way you wish, but would appreciate that. I'm going to the R version with the individual.
Yes, for House Bill 6, version R.
And I'll object.
And we do have an objection. Further discussion.
I just want to speak to the objection. I do believe that judiciary is a place to handle the questions that I raised. I think it's really ducking to send this to the floor with these questions unanswered in my mind. So I don't want to stand in the way of the bill passing. I'm not going to withdraw my objection, but I have no problem if the committee moves it. That's fine. But they're still, I just want to make it clear on the record that these are questions that I have in my mind, that we have an opportunity here to, I think, for the good of the university and the good of the state of Alaska, put some different parameters, test some different parameters here on the removal of a regent. And so I'm going to maintain my objection.
And I'll put on the record, Mr. Chair, that I'm happy to continue the dialogue and see if there's some accommodation that can be reached. I try to do my best for that, and I'll do that here.
Thank you.
Okay, further discussion on we have an objection. Seeing none, I guess we'll have to vote to move this forward. Go right ahead.
Representative Keller.
No.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Lynn is not present. Representative Gatto is not present. Present. 4 yes, 1 no, Mr. Chairman.
4 yes, 1 no. So House Bill 6 will move from committee, version R. Okay, if everybody please stick around to sign the paperwork on House Bill 6. Our next judiciary meeting will be held on Wednesday, April 6th at 1 p.m. At this meeting, we will be hearing House Bill 215, Judicial Review of Pipeline Right-of-Way, pending referral, and Senate Bill 31, Counting of Right-In Votes, and also previously heard bills as might be coming up. So now at 2:50 p.m., I adjourn this meeting of the Judiciary Committee.